I would like to underscore six important issues in The Burning Tigress, dimensions of the book that have emerged in my research and writing as profoundly important and have had a profound effect on me in the work that I've done. And then I'd like to close by reading several snippets from the book to give you a sense of the book's texture and its many voices. It's a book with many voices. I'd like to first start by noting that the Armenian Genocide is a landmark event. A landmark event. It changed history. It was unprecedented. It began the age of genocide, which we must acknowledge the 20th century indeed was. Many of us in this room are familiar with Adolf Hitler's now quite well-known statement made 8 days before the Nazis invaded Poland, who today, after all, speaks of the annihilation of the Armenians, made on August 22 of 1939. Hitler was inspired by what the Turks had managed to do to their Armenian population in 1915. And Hitler was also inspired by the fact that the Armenian Genocide, that had been the largest international human rights issue of the second decade of the 20th century, had fallen into the amnesia well only 20 years later. Pol Pot's genocide in Cambodia in the late 1970s, the Rwandan genocide of 1994, and other genocidal episodes that scar the 20th century map, all in some way or other dovetail, tie into the Armenian genocide, which has sadly become the template for genocide in the modern era. I believe firmly that no history can be told, no history of the 20th century certainly can be told adequately without a serious and comprehensive understanding of the Armenian genocide. And clearly no history of World War I can be told adequately without understanding the Armenian genocide. Theodore Roosevelt put it very well in a letter to Cleveland Dodge in May of 1918 when he said the Armenian massacre was the greatest crime of the war. And just as Hitler used a world war as a screen and an ambience of chaos and total war behind which he carried out an extermination program of a detested minority population, so too did the Young Turk government begin this idea with World War I, using and exploiting World War I. It certainly has now become important for me, dramatic to me, having written this particular book, to say that no history of the United States can be adequately understood without understanding how and why the cause and movement for the Armenian people, which began in 1894 and unfurled for four decades, became America's first international human rights movement. That's half of the twined history of the Burning Tigress, the other half, of course, being the genocide itself. And it also strikes me as of landmark importance to note that the Armenian genocide spawned two formidable international human rights rubrics and statements. First, the Allies meeting in London in May of 1915 sent a very pointed message to the Turkish government, noting that if Turkey continued its massacres of the Armenian people, it would be held responsible for, and the new phrase was, crimes against humanity. It would be held responsible for crimes against humanity. And secondly, Raphael Lemkin, the Polish-Jewish jurist and legal scholar who coined the word genocide and invented the international concept genocide, did so in large part on the basis of what had happened to the Armenians in 1915 and in large part on the basis of what was happening then to the Jews of Europe. The second issue I'd like to pause over is the American story. I want to circle back to it. I just mentioned it. I want to say that discovering this for me as an Americanist was a dramatic and exciting piece of scholarship. International human rights in America began on the Monday before Thanksgiving in 1894 in Boston at Faneuil Hall, that place known as the Cradle of Liberty, because of the role it played in the American Revolution and the role it played in launching abolitionism in the decades before the Civil War. And here again, launching international human rights under the auspices of the distinguished feminist and woman suffrage advocate and writer Juliet Ward Howe, who was the president of the United Friends of Armenia. And she gathered in Faneuil Hall, to a packed Faneuil Hall, to nearly 1,000 people in that space. Around her, her colleagues, William Lloyd Garrison, Jr., Alice Stone Blackwell, Isabel Barrows, Reverend June Barrows, and others. That movement that was responding to the massacres, the beginning, the first phase of the massacres of the Armenians under Abdul Hamid II's reign. As you know, between 1894 and 1896, more than 200,000 Armenians perished as a result of wanton empire-wide massacres against the Armenians. And the American response to this was overwhelming. Before it was all over, intellectuals and cultural leaders such as Mark Twain, Stephen Crane, Henry Adams, William James, Henry James, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, later on in the teens, H.L. Mencken, Ezra Pound, Woodrow Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt, Rabbi Stephen Wise, and others would have weighed in on, responded to, advocated for the Armenian atrocities, advocated for justice, relief, and rescue for the Armenians in the wake of Turkish massacre. Clara Barton, the mother of the American Red Cross, the founder of the American Red Cross, would take the first mission ever out of the country. The first international Red Cross mission ever would be taken by Clara Barton to the killing fields of Armenia in February of 1896. And if you read her famous history of the Red Cross in War and Peace, you'll find the largest chapter in that book is the chapter on the Armenian mission. During the genocide period, a philanthropic organization was started called the American Committee on Armenian Atrocities. Before World War I was over, this would have evolved or morphed into something called Near East Relief. Near East Relief became the largest international philanthropic project in American history. It began with its intense focus on the Armenian crisis. Before the 1920s were over, Near East Relief sent over $110 million in American relief and American money, aid, relief, foodstuffs to the stricken refugees of the Ottoman Empire. Most of them starving Armenians, as the phrase was, the epithet was in the popular mind, but also to the Assyrians, the Greeks, the Syrian Christians, the other Christian minorities who were in deep distress in the wake of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and much massacre and deportation. $110 million by the standards of our currency today is about $2.5 billion. So you can imagine a grassroots movement, and I want to emphasize I've been mentioning intellectuals and cultural leaders, but this was a profoundly grassroots movement emanating from churches, synagogues, Sunday schools, Lions clubs, Kiwanis clubs, Rotary clubs, Sunday school ice cream fundraisers and lemonade fundraisers and strawberry shortcake fundraisers. I read about all of them in local newspapers, all for the starving Armenians. The phrase was coined by Clara Barton in 1895. So you can get a sense of the grassroots dimension of this movement and also the participation of major tycoons and industrialists. John D. Rockefeller Sr., John D. Rockefeller Jr., both gave heavily to Armenian relief, as did Jacob Schiff, Spencer Trask, and others. In the press, in the media, the Armenian genocide was covered in an enormous and broad way. The New York Times alone in 1915, alone just in 1915, published 145 articles on the Armenian genocide. That's an article every 2.2.